You are listening to The News Project, in studio. Brought to you by GNAT TV.
Hello and welcome back to another edition of GNAT TV's In-Depth Series. I'm Andrew McKeever, the news director at GNAT TV's News Project. It's a pleasure to have you with us today on Thursday, May 19th. It's also a great pleasure to be joined for our conversation today by Senator Keisha Ram Hinsdale, who is one of the candidates running for the U.S. Congress in the Democratic Party primary. Senator Ram Hinsdale first entered Vermont politics in 2008 when she ran for the State House right out of graduating from the University of Vermont, and she served in the House of Representatives in the Vermont State House until 2016 when she ran for Lieutenant Governor. She returned to the State House in 2020, successfully running for the State Senate, and that's where she's been serving ever since. Senator Ram Hinsdale, thank you very much for making the time for our conversation today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Andrew. It's a privilege to be here.
Well, let me start off with the obvious question, and one that you probably already answered a couple of thousand times, I would imagine. What prompted you to run for the Congress this year?
Absolutely. I'm Keisha Ram Hinsdale, and I'm running for Congress to be Vermont's fighter for our working families, our climate, and our democracy. These are some of the same reasons I got into politics in the first place when I ran for the legislature at the age of 22. And when I started that year, we were in the free fall of the Great Recession. When I started in the Senate, we were in the free fall of the pandemic. In between, I've served through the aftermath of Tropical Storm Irene and helping to rebuild the state. And I have a very keen sense of how to help make sure Vermonters get back on their feet and don't suffer the long-term effects of these downturns. I've fought for working families my entire career, and I'm somebody who's dreamed big and delivered on those promises. I don't walk away from the negotiating table empty-handed, and we can talk a little bit more about the work I've done to ensure that all Vermonters are represented in such a critical time for our state and our country when we're watching our rights slip away and really need to have fighters in Washington shoring up access to the ballot box, access to reproductive care, and making sure that all Vermonters are taken care of coming out of this crisis.
So let's unpack then some of the major issues you see as paramount for Vermont that would need to be tackled at the federal level. One of them, at least judging from your website, is climate change and the climate crisis. I'm just wondering, that's been an awfully difficult issue for many people. I've tried hard to kind of bring climate change issues to the forefront and solutions to them. What do you think is the way... divorcing from fossil fuels and doing other things that are necessary to reduce the climate's temperature need to be done?
So you're absolutely right that, climate change is one of the top issues for Vermonters, but they often feel a lot of despair and don't think that there's much difference between the candidates on how climate change might be addressed. First of all, I'm really proud to have the support of Bill McKibben in this race. He's somebody who I've stood alongside with through efforts to divest from fossil fuels, through trying to figure out our best and most compassionate environmental and climate change solutions. And I'm proud to have his support in this race. And the reality is we have a lot of the solutions at our disposal to transition to a green economy, to renewable energy, to power our grid. What we don't have is the political will and the investment to go along with it. And that's really critical because we know that Americans need to feel like their fortunes will rise with a transition to a clean, green economy. And if they feel like, hey, I'm giving up a $60 an hour job on a pipeline or in a coal mine for the uncertainty of installing solar panels or being on a manufacturing line, then you are not really centering those who need to be centered to create a middle class in a new clean economy. So really, climate change is tied directly into good paying jobs and stopping our corporate handouts to the fossil fuel industry and instead putting more resources into the research and development, in ensuring that our renewable energy economy is solid.
I think you make an interesting point there with the connection between climate change and good paying jobs and the green economy, because I think that's clearly an issue for many working folks who kind of see their economic future as kind of being endangered if, well, good paying jobs and fossil fuels go away. Do you think that means that the federal government ought to really step up like training or retraining programs for those workers who are going to be, no longer employed in those good paying jobs?
The fight of my career, Andrew, before it had a name, was the Green New Deal. I got into the legislature looking at communities that were left behind economically and environmentally. I would travel the state visiting mobile home communities, sites of former asbestos mines, migrant farm workers, indigenous communities, and seeing that, you know, people are suffering from that dual disaster of not having an economic future and not feeling like they live in a healthy community. And we can actually solve both at the same time. And that's why my environmental justice bill was the first bill I introduced when I was a senior in college at the University of Vermont. And the environmental justice bill was one of the last bills we passed this session. I've been working on that bill for 16 years. We finally passed it. And it's a lens through which to look at our economy and our environmental regulation to figure out who's being most left behind and bring them to the forefront and make sure that if they don't have access to transportation to get to a doctor's appointment or grocery store, we also count that as a benefit of transitioning to a green economy. We get them access to an electric bus or an electric vehicle. And we think about those who would otherwise not be able to participate in the environmental movement and as those on the front lines that we're trying to give the most access to a new future.
One of the other points you make on your website is, and apparently an important policy prescription for you is provide Medicare for all. Again, I guess that's a question of, that sounds like that would be an expensive thing to do from the federal government standpoint, or at least require reconfiguring how tax dollars are dispensed. How would you approach bringing that from its current status of being people who are eligible in their mid-60s for Medicare to one that provides Medicare for everybody?
Once again, you know, the money is out there, the money exists in the economy, and the money is being drained every day from the pocketbooks of everyday Vermonters who are deeply underinsured. People are struggling with high deductibles, high copays, to the point that they, you know, are paying thousands of dollars a month for their family's health insurance and still feeling like they're not going to be able to access it unless something catastrophic were to happen. And even then, that would probably put them in medical debt. So definitionally, we are struggling with, dollars leaving Vermonters' pockets, Americans' pockets, and not going to making them any better off. I'm proud to have the support of Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal and her Medicare for All PAC. She's been a leader on this front, and not only do we have to watchdog, where our dollars are going in healthcare, but Medicare is now being chipped away at by the private sector, and they want more and more of a piece of that pie. And those dollars go to their shareholders and their bottom line, and not to the health of Americans. So we know the dollars are there. It might be expensive when you look at the sticker price, but we've tried this in Vermont. I was there for the fight for single-payer healthcare. What we know is it needs to be a system-wide approach. We do need the help of the federal government to make this work. And states like Vermont should at least be allowed to be experiment stations for figuring out universal unified healthcare until we can, you know, really have that option available at the federal level and move people toward a solution where we know they'll be fully insured and can access their healthcare so they stay well, rather than us spending a lot of money on people who are experiencing chronic illness or the dollars going at the end of life to, you know, impossible situations that cost Americans a lot of money.
I wanted to turn to a couple of issues that are kind of fall into the current events category, I guess. One of them being, of course, the controversy and discussion surrounding the possibility the U.S. Supreme Court will overturn the Roe v. Wade decision. I'm assuming you would be a supporter of Vermont's Proposition 5 that would ensure that. But I guess what is your reaction in general, I guess, to that? I guess we have to be mindful it's a draft opinion that was leaked a couple of weeks ago, and the final decision may be somewhat different. But if it basically turns out to be roughly the same as the document that was leaked, what is your reaction to that?
You know, Andrew, this might be jarring for some of your audience, so I want to give them that warning. But we need to break the stigma around talking about abortion, because abortion is healthcare. You know, people who can reproduce experience a lot of traumas and personal decisions that are challenging to make around trying to keep from getting pregnant, having a miscarriage, you know, and now all of that is being criminalized, and government is beginning to talk about interfering in what are some of the most private decisions that we can make. I had an abortion when I was in college. You know, I was studying at in Washington, D.C., and I knew I needed to, you know, have a life that in college and an early life that where I didn't wasn't planning a family at that time. And so I went to the Planned Parenthood Clinic in Washington, D.C., and as you can imagine, perhaps, it's a lightning rod politically, and there were throngs of people, you know, pulling at my clothes, praying in my ear, and probably a volunteer worker, you know, came up to me, created a safety barrier around me, and said, "I've got you," and brought me into that clinic to get the healthcare that I needed. And that's what we have to say. That's what I am saying to all Vermonters and all Americans. I've got you. You will still be able to access abortion care. You will still be able to access meeting your basic healthcare needs, because that's what this is. And, you know, the ways that these laws are becoming so insidious, criminalizing miscarriage, criminalizing ectopic pregnancy abortions where someone is at risk of death. You know, the right-wing conservatives are making zero exceptions for the health of a mother, for the health of a baby. You could be bringing a baby into the world that will not be able to survive on its own. These are such intimate decisions, and they belong between a woman and her doctor and her own beliefs. And so I will fight tooth and nail. I'm proud to have been part of enshrining abortion in our own constitution in Vermont, but that's not good enough. You know, we need to be able to beat this back on the front lines and restore Roe v. Wade as the floor, and then make sure that we have better access to reproductive health care for all Americans, far and above just the privacy of being able to make this decision. We are still underfunding and undervaluing healthy births to the point that we have disparities in maternal mortality and, you know, the complications around birth. And, you know, we look right now in the country, we have Republicans who are saying that we should respect the sanctity of life, and they're voting against emergency efforts to get baby formula and infant formula to parents who are in desperate need. So if we're truly going to be pro-life, what we need to do is take care of children when they are born, take care of mothers, take care of families, make sure kids get the head start that they need, and really look at the full picture. So I will be an absolute champion for choice and for abortion care in this country.
The other sort of current event topic I wanted to ask you about was, you know, grows out of that tragic event that took place in Buffalo, New York over the past weekend. One in a long, long, long series of mass shooting events where, you know, many people are in the wrong place at the wrong time. Is there ever going to come a time when the federal government is going to be able to enact some kind of rules and regulations that folks who are passionate about the Second Amendment will be able to accept and live with, that would at least make it vastly more difficult for people to obtain these military-style assault rifles that seem to be used frequently in events, not just the one in Buffalo, but Las Vegas or Parkland, Florida, or wherever these tragedies happen to occur?
Well, first, I just want to say, you know, it's extremely tragic and jarring, you know, what took place in Buffalo and what takes place every day in this country when people live in fear of going to the grocery store or going to a place of worship or leaving their house in general because of gun violence. It's particularly frightening for Black Americans. And in this case, you know, the frightening discussion around Americans starting to buy into this replacement theory idea that gives them yet another excuse to commit violence toward Black Americans and Brown Americans. It's a really, really frightening situation, and particularly for those who are experiencing this as terrorism. So I wanted to start by saying that and then say, you know, it actually struck me, you know, as I worked for victims of domestic violence as the legal director for our advocacy program in Chittenden County, and in a lot of the work I've done, when folks who are on the side of the NRA will say, well, why don't we enforce the laws we have on the books then? And I actually have to say, let us start there. You know, we do have some strong gun laws on the books. And even in Vermont, we don't always have them enforced. I've been a fighter in the legislature for educating my colleagues about what actually happens when someone goes to get a relief from abuse order. Often that is our kind of red flag law. This person is dangerous to an individual, for a former intimate partner, spouse, in all likelihood, and they should not have access to a weapon. And what happens from there is a very chaotic process of trying to get someone that actual relief of having guns taken away from an abusive person. You know, you really have to advocate for that. Right now in Vermont, they can just go to someone's family member, an abuser's family member, and, you know, that person can say, hey, I actually really want to go hunting. Can I have my guns back? And they might end up getting them back, and it causes people to live in terror. When you look at the shooter in the Buffalo case, New York has very strong gun laws. You know, there is a red flag law that should have captured this person's access to a weapon. And, you know, police are saying they're not going to comment further on why it didn't stop him from getting a weapon. There might be investigation into, you know, how he accessed a weapon and whether it was sort of an under the table transaction. But truly, you know, we have a responsibility to enforce the laws on the books evenly. And that again ties back to why many Black Americans live in fear that anytime they quote unquote step out of line, they will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. And, you know, a white male who had been involved in other shootings, who had been radicalized on the internet, who had made other threats, who was 18 years old, could simply get access to an assault weapon. You know, those kinds of things are really what's wrong in this country just as much as access to guns.
I also wanted to ask you, I mean, one of the major topics of discussion here in Vermont and nationwide, and I believe sort of also up in the Burlington area where you've represented a district, is the question of policing. A lot of people heard defund the police and thought that that meant people wanted to have fewer police officers. My sense was always that that spoke more to restructuring a police force to bring in, let's say, more mental health workers or social workers to assist uniformed officers when they might be going into a potentially explosive family dispute of some sort or another and would be there to de-escalate that situation. Is that the direction you think we ought to be going in terms of policing, or is it more the case of, you know, no, we just need fewer police officers because we have as many as we need?
Well, I think there's sort of a third discussion that we need to have in this context, which is we are asking police officers to do too much in society. And they are crying out saying, you know, that they are only trained to get involved in situations that are already escalated. And if there's a situation with a mental health crisis, you know, with complicating factors where there are victims that need, you know, comforting and support, where it's unclear who is a victim and who is perpetrating violence, you know, they only have so many tools in their toolbox. They are being asked to address poverty and mental health and a lack of support in our education system and a lack of funding for a lot of other community supports and resources, a lack of safe, healthy ways for kids to engage in activities. And so, you know, it's not about defunding the police. It's about funding public safety solutions that aren't solely resting on law enforcement to enact and maintain. And that's what I've always said. And basically, when a community stops trusting law enforcement officers, the whole situation becomes more unsafe. It means that, you know, people are willing to defund or scale back their law enforcement without figuring it out with law enforcement at the table to say what other solutions need to be in place so we can do our jobs well. But, you know, this is a crisis in Vermont, and I've been saying that for years. Southern Vermont is the gateway to our state. We've heralded that. When you look at Brattleboro, it was discovered that it's 9 times more likely for a Black man to be pulled over than a white Vermonter. And when you look at Bennington, 75% of people pulled over are Black men. So how welcoming is Vermont truly for Black Americans if that's the situation they're experiencing as they come up through the South and into the rest of the state? We really have to take a strong look at that situation with law enforcement at the table and ask what's wrong and how can we fix it. I had a bill this year that passed, I hope the governor will sign it, that looks a lot deeper into the data and also tries to ensure that we don't use false information when we interrogate someone who we suspect may be involved in a crime, and that we look into creating a database of police misconduct. Because, you know, a law enforcement officer might be able to go from one place to another without the state's attorney in that area or someone else knowing if they had been accused of falsifying information or it had been found that they had done that. So we want to trust law enforcement, and to do that, we need systems of accountability.
I'm interested to hear your thoughts about what we might need to do to avoid a repetition of what we saw on January 6th, 2021. In the U.S. Congress, where we had, I think it's fair to say, an insurrection and an attempt to overturn the results of an election. That's one part. And the other part, I think it was just kind of tied into it, and maybe you can answer both of them in the same way, is the nation right now seems to be very polarized and divided. I mean, that seems to be kind of the conventional wisdom anyway. I mean, I suppose people can differ about that, but it certainly seems like we have reached one of those points in our history, and it's not for the first time either, where we seem to have voices on the extremes speaking much more loudly than those who are in between the extremes. I guess what would be your approach if elected to Congress to try and bridge that? At the same time, you know, without sacrificing some of the policy goals that you seek. Is there something that is not happening in the course of the discourse in Congress, in Washington, elsewhere around the country, that would help us kind of, you know, return to an ability to kind of listen to each other and say, well, I may not agree with you, but okay, it's interesting and you've clearly thought about it?
Yeah, it's a great question, Andrew, because you framed it in a way that I think we should acknowledge. You know, number one, we faced very difficult moments in this country and globally before. My grandfather just passed away over the weekend. He was 95 years old. I don't think he could have lived a better life. And he started his early life with service in World War II. He enlisted when he was 17 and, you know, fought in the Pacific Theater and received a Purple Heart for the danger that he was in. And, you know, he still worried about the place we were in as a country right now, having seen everything he's seen and been through what he's been through. And you look at, you know, the time of President Kennedy's assassination, we were in deep turmoil as a country, and we were building new coalitions and trying to figure out, you know, where everyone fit in, people all of a sudden getting freedom and access to resources that they hadn't before, particularly communities of color. And when you look at all of that, I think the really big difference today is that people who feel, people who have sense of conspiracy, excuse me, around what's going on, can find each other a lot more easily. People who are like-minded are far more likely to be in community and space without, you know, talking to people who have differences of opinion. We now know that about 99% of Americans live in communities beyond racial and economic segregation that are politically segregated, where they don't have to listen a lot to people who have other opinions. And over the course of recent history, about 50 years ago, only about 5% of Americans would say that they felt strongly that their son or daughter, if they married someone of a different political party, would they be upset or disown them. It's over 50% now. So politics has become a religion and a deep part of our culture in a way that is continuing to divide Americans and make them feel like they can dehumanize somebody who believes something different than them. Our media is reinforcing that. Where we live is reinforcing that, and the choices we make about who to talk to are reinforcing that. And in fact, even if you go on social media, you know, the attitude is walk away from a family member and never talk to them again if you disagree with them at the Thanksgiving table. You know, protect yourself, leave that community. We are, you know, even in Vermont, I've walked around farmers markets and met people who said, I'm afraid now to live in Florida or the Deep South, so I moved up to Vermont. And you can't fault people for going where they feel safe, but that simply reinforces that we are no longer able to resolve conflicts by hashing them out across difference. And I think there's a number of things we need to do. I think Vermont, you know, we still have an ability to connect with each other. We live in a small scale, you know, and at the same time, we're a pretty homogenous state. So, you know, we may not have all the answers, but I do think, you know, here in rural America, we can advance important solutions. I think we need, you know, people talk about civics in schools. I think we need to talk about conflict resolution and having a shared language around how we resolve conflicts and talk about differences that we currently don't have enough of in our schools. You have, even in Vermont, a lot of kids you know, using slurs or engaging in behavior that they see mimicked from Congress or on television. And so I often go to young people and ask them to be better than the adults that they're seeing around them. You know, two, we need to model that in our leadership. And, you know, more and more we're being asked to create enemies when we talk about, you know, what's wrong in this country. And we need to start to also talk about our common ground and what we share. My great mentor in the legislature, Patty Comline, who was the Republican minority leader, would say, you know, hey, you're in the majority, that means you steer the ship. But we're in the same boat, and I'm here to point out the rocks in the minority, because we're all going to sink together. And, you know, we need to remember that that kind of attitude can exist and not simply create enemies out of one another. It's much easier said than done. You know, I don't think if I'm fortunate enough to end up in Washington, I'd be best friends with Marjorie Taylor Greene. But we need to still celebrate the courage to stand up for what is right and try to find common ground without giving away our rights and our core values. And I truly believe it's still possible, and that that's what our next generation is hungry to see in Washington.
Okay, well, we'll have to leave it there. Unfortunately, I feel like we could probably talk for another half an hour very easily, and it would be a fascinating conversation. But I do want to thank you, Senator Rahm Hinsdale, for making the time for our talk today. And, well, best of luck out there on the campaign trail. And I guess the primary is on August 9th, so we'll know then.
Absolutely.
Meanwhile, thank you all of you who've been watching our program today. Hope you found it interesting, and well, we'll see you again the next time. Take care.
Thank you for listening local. For more local content, visit gnat.tv.